Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Wednesday, January 21st, 2015. President Kiir travels to Arusha to sign an agreement on reuniting the SPLM.
All the issues that are outstanding will be resolved within the party. The president left today for Arusha. He is going to attend that meeting. And that meeting may lead to the signing of an agreement for the reunification of the party.
And South Sudan is going ahead with its plans for elections in June this year.
We, the members of the high election committees, will work as teams. What I will request from the National Election Commission is to give us very clear directives.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. But first, we go to Arusha. There is a word today from Ezekiel Lulgathquot, the SPLM in opposition Deputy Secretary for Foreign Affairs, that government and rebel negotiators meeting in Arusha have agreed on several major changes regarding the leadership of the SPLM ruling party. There is no confirmation from the government on these points, but here they are, according to Gathquot. Number one, all SPLM officials unjustifiably dismissed shall be reinstated, including rebel leader Riek Machar. Number two, all positions in the ruling party are, quote, up for grabs or can be contested. Number three, a secret ballot will be conducted on controversial issues not yet agreed to, and a show of hands will decide non-contentious issues among the issues not agreed, according to Gathquot. Number four, President Kiir will step down as the head of the party. And number five, the SPLM leadership shall be reconstituted with both current and former SPLM officials. Government spokesperson Michael Makwilu describes why the meeting is important.
The people who are fighting and who are negotiating are actually all SPLM. There is the SPLM government, there is the SPLM rebels, there is SPLM former detainees. And this is why the initiative of Arusha was very important, that we unite the ranks. And if we can reunite the party, if we can reunite the SPLM, then definitely there will be no reason for us to continue fighting any longer. Because all the issues that are outstanding will be resolved within the party. By the way, the president left today for Arusha. He left this morning for Arusha. He is going to attend that meeting. And that meeting may lead to the signing of an agreement for the reunification of the party.
It is not clear what has taken place so far at today's meeting in Tanzania. Several heads of states are expected in Arusha should there be a signing ceremony, including President Jakaya Kikwete of Tanzania, President Yoweri Museveni of Uganda, President Uhuru Kenyatta of Kenya, Deputy President Cyril Ramaphosa of South Africa, and Ali Mohamed Shein of Zanzibar, Prime Minister Haile Mariam Desalegn of Ethiopia, and finally, of course, South Sudan's President Salva Kiir and former Vice President rebel leader Riek Machar. The South Sudan government is accusing rebels loyal to former Vice President Riek Machar of attacking an oil facility in Unity State and setting it on fire. Government spokesman Michael Makui says the attack is a clear violation of recent agreement reached by the warring sides at talks in Khartoum that were mediated by Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi. For VOA News, Charlton Doki reports from Juba.
Makui told reporters in Juba today that rebels attacked an oil facility at Thomas House in the northern part of Unity State early this week.
This area is an area where the production of so many wells are pooled and then directed towards the processing center in Hijlich. They set this place on fire. It was not operational, of course, since that area is under the rebels, but nevertheless they decided to set it on fire. And The fire was burning up to yesterday. We don't know how far has it gone now.
Makwei noted that one of the issues that government and rebel officials agreed on last week at the talks mediated by China was the protection of foreign personnel and economic installations, including oil facilities. Makwei says the rebel attack on an oil installation in Unity State is a clear violation of that agreement.
If the rebels were really genuine and serious in their talks, would there be any reason for them at this particular phase to destroy an oil installation? This, to us, is a very clear case of lack of seriousness. The rebels are not serious. They don't want peace and they want war.
Oil is the backbone of South Sudan's economy, and most, if not all, crude is pumped in Unity and Upper Nile states. Those two states also happen to have borne the brunt of the now 13-month-old conflict in South Sudan. Makwei warned the rebels against launching more attacks on oil facilities.
These installations belong to all of us. If there is any group of people who do not care about public properties, then it is our duty to make them understand that these are public properties and the government of the Republic of South Sudan is under duty to defend and protect these properties.
Makwei also lashed out at the United Nations Mission in South Sudan, or UNMISS, accusing it of not protecting South Sudanese civilians and facilities like the oil field in Unity State.
One of the tasks of UNMISS is the protection of the civil population and the installations. There is no civil population being protected. There is no installation being protected. And as such, we don't know what is the task, what is the mission of UNMISS in South Sudan. This is something that we will need clarification from UNMISS here as to what is their task.
The South Sudanese government and opposition complained last year when the UN Security Council changed the focus of the UN mission's mandate from promoting development and nation building in the young country to protecting civilians and ending the conflict that began in December 2013. The resolution passed by the Security Council in May calls on UNMISS to, quote, deter violence against civilians, including foreign nationals, in areas at high risk of conflict, including schools, places of worship, hospitals, and the oil installations, in particular when the government of the Republic of South Sudan is unable or failing to provide such security, unquote. UN officials have said repeatedly that the government should take the lead in protecting civilians and key infrastructure. Makwei also called on the Regional Intergovernmental Authority on Development, or IGAD, to take action against the rebels, violating the cessation of hostilities agreement brokered by IGAD and signed by both sides almost a year ago today.
The rebels have been violating the cessation of hostilities for that long. We have been waiting to see what action will be taken by the IGAD and by the protection force which is deployed here. But unfortunately, nothing comes out as that now. Our question is, for how long will this situation continue unresolved? This time, we demand that the IGAD must come out clearly on this issue. And it is our right to know what action is IGAD taking.
IGAD and the United Nations have accused both sides in South Sudan's conflict of violating the cessation of hostilities agreement. Makwei says that in spite of numerous violations of the deal by the rebels, the government will continue to use peaceful means to try to end the conflict in South Sudan. For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Juba.
The military spokesman for Machar's armed opposition group is blaming South Sudan government forces for destroying the oil facility in Unity State. Lul Kong says his troops defended themselves after they came under heavy fire from South Sudan armed forces at the facility in Pariang County.
What is happening is that the government troops came to attack our forces with the intention of recapturing all the oil fields under our control. And in the process of opening fire on our forces, they ended up destroying oil facilities. So in summary, it is not true that we destroyed oil facilities. It is the government that destroyed oil facilities in the process of trying to dislodge us from the area.
How many oil fields are under your control? Could you list the oil fields that are under your control?
Not really. That's not possible. Almost 99% of oil fields in Unity State are under our control. And that's why there is no oil production in Unity State. The government is relying on oil facilities and oil production in Upper Nile State.
So you are saying the oil fields in Unity State are all under your control. Which areas are we talking about? Which areas in Unity State exactly? Can you tell us which areas?
We have a number of oil fields in Parian County. That's why the government is on the offensive to take back the oil facilities. The same thing in Guit, Coach, and parts of Mayom. These are the most productive areas in Unity State.
You sign a cessation of hostilities to say you will not fight each other. And in Khartoum, during the Chinese-sponsored consultative talks, both of you agreed that you will respect the cessation of hostilities. Why is this still coming up that you guys are fighting each other?
Well, you see, John, we are fighting in self-defense. We came under heavy attacks, and we had the right to fight back. We had the right to defend ourselves. So it should be the government to answer that question. Why are they attacking us when we have a cessation of hostilities agreement in force?
Of course, it takes two people to fight, not one.
Of course, are you telling us that we should be fired hard without returning fire? Is what you are expecting us to do so that you are satisfied that we are observing cessation of hostilities?
The two of you agreed that you will not fight each other. This is just what I'm trying to put across.
That's correct, John, but the problem is that the government is on the offensive with the intention of retaking oil fields from us. The right method should be reaching an amicable solution so that if need be, we withdraw from oil fields voluntarily without the government trying to take the oil fields from us by force. This is where the problem lies.
That's Lul Kongroy, the military spokesman for the SPLA in opposition. He was speaking with me from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, earlier today. The chairperson of South Sudan's National Election Commission held a swearing-in ceremony for officials who will run elections at the state level later this year. Abednego Akok Kachwol says his commission will soon begin to register voters across the country.
I, as a member of the State High Elections Committee,
dozens of election officials repeat the words of South Sudan's Chief Justice Chan Riek Madut as they were sworn in today in Juba. Last week, Akok appointed 5 election officials from each of the 10 states. Malak Ajang Alak is chairperson of the Jonglei State High Election Committee.
I thank the National Election Commission for the trust that they've given to us. I assure you, we, the members of the High Election Committees, will work as teams. What I would request from the National Election Commission is to give us very clear directives.
Ajang acknowledges the elections are being held as fighting continues in South Sudan and there is a shortage of resources to hold elections.
Election is a process. It may not be perfect. It may not be like that one of the United States. It may not be like that one of Australia. It may not be like that one of Canada or France and the Western world, but we are in the process. We should not give up. We try our best, but let us try this one. The others will improve in the future.
Akok insists his commission's decision to hold elections is in accordance with the National Elections Act and the Transitional Constitution.
We have declared the election date according to the Act, not me. It is what the nation wrote. That's what I implemented. I'm not doing that out of my own will. No, I'm guided by the Act. High committees are established, not me. It is the law.
According to the National Elections Act, the polls should be held only after a national census is conducted. That census has not yet taken place. Akok says in lieu of that fact, the elections will be held on the basis of the constituencies agreed during the 2010 elections before South Sudan separated from Sudan. And he says residents of the disputed Abyei region will not participate in the coming elections.
Abyei is a disputed area. Discussions are going on between Sudan and Southern Sudan government. It ought to be resolved politically first. And then from there, it will be known where does it fall. But at the moment, they are to be represented in the assembly through appointment by the President of the Republic of Southern Sudan.
Cork adds that election officials will register the more than 100,000 internally displaced people who are taking refuge at UN camps across the country. Charlton Doki prepared this report from Juba. You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, mob justice rules at Juba Teaching Hospital, where hundreds of women staged a protest yesterday. That story after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
which setting do you prefer, urban or rural, and why?
For mine, I prefer urban areas, because urban areas has many benefits in terms of infrastructures, buildings, roads, opportunities of work, opportunities of studies, while the rural areas doesn't have those opportunities.
I prefer urban because there's life, entertainment, infrastructures, which is not in rural areas.
I prefer rural areas because as one wants to be entrepreneur, he may find many business ideas in rural areas.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. A South Sudanese journalist says he was beaten by a mob at Juba Teaching Hospital yesterday when he went to report on the peaceful demonstrations we told you about yesterday, held by communities from northern Juba County who were protesting inter-ethnic violence in central Equatorial State. John Anyang says a group of men and women attacked him and took his cell phone and a recorder at the entrance of the hospital. He says he is recovering from the injuries he sustained during the attack. Anyang says he does not know why the mob attacked him.
The Citizen newspaper journalists who had gone there before me, and then also Juba Monitor, plus some of my colleagues who work with me daily. So I got them there, and they had gone there before to take up some snaps of the people, of the corpses and everything. So that one angered the Bari community. So they chased the journalists out of the hospital. During that time, we rushed out. When we reached the gate, so they stopped us. I was working with a voice recorder, a pen, and a notebook.
Who stopped you?
The mob. They stopped us. They were asking me, whose photos were you taking before? I said, I was not taking any photos. I've just come. They said, no, but what is that you're holding? I said, this is not even a camera. This is a voice recorder. They said, now, what is the use of the voice recorder? I said, since I'm a journalist, I take voices with it. When I was explaining, a crowd developed around us. All eyes were on me. So the mob started beating me up.
Do you know the identity of the people who were beating you? Were they ordinary people? Were this, you know, organized group?
Wow, it was a very big number of people. I think there were even beyond 1,000 people. There were beyond, very many. And many of them were men, and then the few who accompanied them were women. The questions they were asking me while they were beating me was that, what tribe are you? I said, I'm a Dinka. And then they said, now, what about your occupation? I said, I'm a journalist. The other question is that, why do you involve in something that you do not know?
You told me that the hospital was surrounded by security officials and people were not allowed to get into the hospital. While this was happening to you, where were the police?
The emergency police, the security people were outside with their four vehicles, as I stated before. But I don't know why they did not come. The ones who came now to rescue me is the military police from a different station came for my rescue. I'm now feeling well, but yesterday I was so unconscious. But now I'm okay.
Yeah, with all this happening, how would you describe the media environment in South Sudan? You have been working there as a journalist for quite a long time.
I think it is not so good. Even if we say we have a media bill, I think it is not yet safe for journalists.
Why is it not safe for journalists?
Because if you can get beaten without any clear reason like this, not only this, many journalists have so far died. Before me, people died as journalists. They get threatened as journalists. they get beaten up, like me, as journalists. No clear reasons.
And with all this happening, do you still have the energy and the zeal to do your work as a journalist in South Sudan?
Yeah, I will do it because this is my occupation. This is what I can do. Without it, I think I'm not doing anything. Without it, even if I get another job, I don't think I can ever do that job as I do journalism.
That's South Sudanese journalist John Anyang. Anyang works for the Nation Mirror, a daily English newspaper in Juba. He was speaking to me from Juba earlier today. Speaking yesterday here in Washington at the opening of a conference on journalist security, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry said, "Everyone knows journalism can be dangerous. The risk, he says, is in keeping silent." That Kerry is called, he says, "Silence gives power to dictators, to abusers, and to tyrannies." Kerry added, he named places like Syria, Somalia, Central African Republic as examples of places where government don't want people to tell the story. He did not mention South Sudan by name. Various journalists from conflict zones around the world were invited. The aim of the conference is to figure out how to better protect international journalists, especially freelancers who do not have the backing of large news organizations to do their job. Officials in Eastern Equatorial State have sprung into action after global health officials say earlier this month that the state has the highest incidence of guinea worm disease in the world. State authorities today announced that more boreholes will be dug and hygiene education campaigns about waterborne diseases caused by a tiny parasite will increase in 2015 in the hopes of preventing new cases. Philip Thornaleu files this report from Juba.
Margaret Eto, the Eastern Equatorial State Minister of Health, says South Sudanese officials have the political will to fight guinea worm disease. Eto is attending the 9th annual B meeting of the South Sudan Guinea Worm Eradication Program in Juba. She says she came to the meeting to assure other participants that the government of Eastern Equatoria is also determined to eliminate guinea worm disease. She says assistance from the Carter Center and UNICEF has helped Eastern Equatorial State make tremendous strides in reducing the number of guinea worm disease cases over the first 9 years.
Even one case to us is a big issue because it disables the person and also reduces the livelihood. We want to get to zero, so we are hopeful. We are all committed. Our governor is here. At the same time, all our commissioners for Kapweta East, where the disease had been endemic, and now we have narrowed mostly to Kapweta East.
Here Guy Cook is the National Minister of Health. Guy says cases of guinea worm has slashed since 2006 when the eradication program was officially launched.
Endemic villages reduced from 3,134 in 2006 to only 13 villages in South Sudan. All these are very encouraging milestones that makes the guinea worm eradication program one of the most successful programs for this generation of South Sudanese.
Guy says resources to fight guinea worm disease are being focused on Eastern Equatoria and Lakes states. The two states combined have 70 cases of guinea worm disease, or more than half the total number of cases in the world. 58 of those cases are in Eastern Equatoria. Even after notching up some significant successes in the fight against guinea worm, Eastern Equatorial State Health Minister Eto admits that there are challenges as the state works to weed out the disease.
Clean water remains a challenge because up to now only 40% of the population is covered with clean water. So what we do is community sensitization, a lot of awareness on hygiene, on health, at the same time providing filters to them, both the pipe and also the cloth, so that where the water is not very clean, they can also filter to avoid the worm being taken.
Eto says more boreholes are being dug. In fact, at the conference today, UNICEF pledged to help provide 50 new boreholes. Guinea worm disease is contracted when people drink water contaminated with guinea worm larva. After a year, a meter-long worm slowly emerges from the body through a fenipal blister in the skin. Because there is no vaccine or effective medical treatment, the ancient disease is being whipped out mainly through community-based interventions to educate and change behaviors. Vice President James Wanyiga, who presides over the opening ceremony of the guinea worm rabies meeting in Juba, says there is a lot more to be done beyond merely constructing new water ponds.
This meeting needs to determine mechanisms that will enable all of us to mobilize what is required, ranging from finance, logistics, and the technical know-how, to enable us to go the extra mile to get the work done. More importantly, this meeting is to learn critical lessons to help the program overcome the hurdles that have prevented us in the past from attaining our objectives.
Iga says South Sudan's objectives is to have no cases of guinea worm disease in 2015. That might sound unrealistic because when the guinea worm eradication program started in 2006, 7 of South Sudan's 10 states reported a total of 20,000 cases. 9 years on, that number was down to just 70 cases in 2 states. If guinea worm disease is wiped out, it will be the first parasitic disease ever to be eradicated. For BOA News, I am Pilithon Aleu in Juba.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Here are some of today's news headlines with South Sudan in Focus editor Carol Van Dam.
Thanks, John. A top Lord's Resistance Army commander is now in custody at the International Criminal Court in The Hague. Dominic Ongwen will undergo medical exams after being flown from the Central African Republic and is expected to make his first court appearance soon. His arrival at the court ends a nearly 10-year effort to have him face 3 counts of crimes against humanity and another 4 counts of war crimes. Nigerian militant group Boko Haram has claimed responsibility for mass killings in the city of Baga and is promising further attacks. A video posted online today shows the Islamist group's leader declaring, "We carried out the Baga massacre and we are going to do more." And finally, Yemen's president remains surrounded by Houthi militiamen in his residence today, a day after the group captured the presidential palace. Houthi militiamen drove tanks through the streets of the capital Sana'a after capturing several key government buildings a day earlier. And that's a look at some of today's top stories. I'm Carol Van Dam.
And that headline news by Carol Van Dam brings us to the end of our show for this Wednesday. We now leave you with the song "Joe Gero" by the Freedom Boys.
You're our people. Just listen to this track and take the meaning. We are the boys in the land. Take the better choice for your freedom. This is the last chance. And people, oh, ask her to look at her, get her soon. To be, oh, someone that can it be a summa pop, the better appear. I'm a poor, he's all young. I, to be, I get it. Time in Shilu, the girl who feed you was who I tell you, feed you up, Mario. Obviously, listen, be killing girls who done the killing against him.
We have been listening to the Freedom Boys with the song "Joe Gero." I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. and we hope you will join us again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.